Everybody, Chris Webster here to talk about one of the latest supporters to the Archaeology Podcast Network, The Motley Fool. Now, I've been investing in the stock market through various applications for a few years now, and everybody who's listening to this can benefit from that sort of investment for the long-term financial planning. And also, I know the hosts of these podcasts can benefit because as archaeologists, like none of us get retirement, we all have to kind of fend for ourselves. So investing in the stock market is a good idea, but not everybody can do it. And look, we get it. The market is complicated and confusing, and to many of us, it simply doesn't make sense. In fact, where do you even start? Take all of the guesswork out of it with The Motley Fool Stock Advisor. The Motley Fool has been around for over 25 years and has been spot on in recommending some of the world's most important companies before they hit the big time. I'm talking about Amazon, Tesla, Netflix, Starbucks, all before they exploded in value. With their easy to use and super informative service, Stock Advisor, you could join the ranks before they potentially find the next big thing. After all, their average stock recommendation is up over 400% as of April 10th, 2023. And no need to be intimidated by financial jargon or market complexities. As the name suggests, these guys don't take themselves too seriously. Now, finances, that's a different story. Their friendly and relaxed approach has helped over 700,000 people move closer to financial independence, all while beating the market and having fun. New members can access Stock Advisor for only $89 for their first year, a full $110 off the full list price. Don't sit on the sidelines and think about what could have happened. Visit fool.com/APN to start your investing journey today. That's $110 discount off of $199 per year list price. Membership will renew annually at the then current list price. So again, check the link in the show notes of this episode.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Welcome. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, for Rock Art Podcast, episode 79. Gracing our humble forum will be David Nichols, who heads up the Cultural Resources Management, the archaeologist for the National Mojave Preserve, A Million Acres. He's going to be talking about some pioneering elements relating to interaction with Native people and how best to sort of think about rock art, archaeology, and heritage values. Welcome out there in archaeology podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and our guest scholar tonight is David Nichols, who works in the National Mojave Preserve and just returned from a cultural tour with the California Rock Art Foundation out in the Great Mural Rock Art. And I think he's going to have a few things to say about Great Basin National Park as well. David, are you there?
I am here, Dr. Gold Garfinkel.
Yes, Goldfinkel. They call me Dr. Goldfish sometimes. Or Dr. G squared.
I was more prone to go with Garfinkel, Gold, Rosemary, and Thyme.
Yes, there you go. I love it. So you're back on terra firma. You came back from the adventures of a lifetime out in the hinterland of the Mexican area, the peninsula.
Yeah, the frontera.
The frontera, yes. And that was sometimes identified as the, you know, it's sort of the Grand Canyon of Mexico is what it is. Sometimes people look at it in that way. The country is rather, I would say, a bit rugged.
Yeah.
What would you say?
It's rugged. It's rugged. Those mules are remarkable. And if it weren't for the assurance that those cowboys, those vaqueros, charros out there told ride those things at nighttime and sleep on the backs of those mules as they had taken them to and from the ranchos.
It's amazing.
I would have been a little less interested in riding on them.
So the story goes is I always talk to the vaqueros. I remember after my trip and I asked them, I said, you know, this has been a wonderful experience, but it's a little bit scary. Cuidado and peligroso. And so,
yeah, it's harrowing.
Right. It's harrowing. And what do you guys think about this trip? And the response was, viaje es muy divertido, which means the trip is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
To them, in their perspective, they don't see nothing that's crazy or dangerous or in any way, shape or form. It's just like falling off a log because they grew up with this stuff.
Right. For them, in my, with the trek that I took for them, you know, the travel itself was kind of old hat. But what was fun for them was for the few gringos on the trip, such as myself, that have some background in the Spanish language, just correct, getting to know us and talking with us and finding out our stories and listening to our versions of jokes is really what they were interested in and had a lot of fun doing.
I'm sure they're very much entertained by these series of gringos who are attempting to stay on the back of these mules with the burros in tow.
Oh yeah.
And try to get up to some of these infamous rock art sites that are literally nested on the side of the cliffs that take a bit of diligence to get up to. In that experience, what's the biggest takeaway that you have from, you know, being out there with them? I know that everyone grabs a little bit of a different perspective on it.
You know, look, the rock art tradition there, and I understand they've, from the archaeological investigations that have been done, they're getting dates back of, I think, 5,000-6,000 before present. It speaks to a sophisticated, possibly hierarchical society there. Just the amount of effort that's being put into the rock art down there, and I'm not just talking about the pictographs, there's some pretty outstanding petroglyph sites that we saw as well. It just suggests some kind of really rather sophisticated ceremonial society that you wouldn't expect given the Spanish records of what they witnessed and the interactions that they had with the indigenous peoples by the time that they were on the peninsula. And it's just mysterious how they got this rock art up on some of these ceilings. I know that scaffolding has been suggested or ladders were built. And I was keeping that in my mind as I was looking at the placement of some of these glyphs on the walls. And even those two suggestions seem rather incredible, even if they had built scaffolding.
Because of the effort, right?
Oh, the effort. But the placement of these images, even so. And you look around at what they could have built scaffolding from, and there's not much there.
No.
It's puzzling. It's very mysterious. You really feel a sense of place and mystery. And, you know, if you ever look at National Register nominations, you know, one of the criteria for archaeological sites is it's indescribable what that feeling is, but you sure feel it at some of those rock art sites down in the great mural tradition.
So, David, I guess we, on these tours, we go in with questions and we leave with questions. Am I correct?
Yeah. And you know, I'd been reading about and studying on that rock art before I ever actually saw it in person. I didn't leave with more questions than I went in with, but I definitely didn't come away with any answers to the questions that I had for that stuff. And I didn't really expect to either. Yeah. But what a fascinating place.
Definitely. I think it hooks your psyche, and some people get absolutely obsessed with it and just continue going back and back and back. I have a friend, Eve Ewing, who's been there about 100 times, and I know that Melanie sketched.
Yeah, I would go back and explore more of the region. I'm not sure I would do the same trip.
That's what seems to happen.
Yeah.
There is a rather robust ethnographic record that goes along with sort of these sets of caves. And there has been several PhDs. There's at least four or five that I'm aware of. Four of them are in Spanish and one is in English. So there's been a tremendous amount that's been done to study and try to investigate and characterize that rock art. But at the latest, we had Eric Ritter, who's, of course, a Baja expert par excellence.
Right.
And he came away and he mentioned some things. He says, yeah, Alan, you know, I still don't think we know much about them stuff. Those rock art panels. There's a lot of questions. And that surprised me.
That's for sure.
So there we go. So segueing from the great mural rock art and the mysteries of the Sierra de San Francisco, you just came back, you told me, from quite a stint with, is it Great Basin National Park?
It is. It's the only national park in Nevada, in the state of Nevada. And it has the only glacier in the state of Nevada and the highest peak in Nevada.
And so they wanted you to participate in this expedition, this multidisciplinary team. And what was the nature of the assignment?
So it was what we call in the National Park Service, and I think in most federal agencies, a detail, a promotion detail for me. 120 days, they had a couple people retire from both natural and cultural resources in that park. So I was brought in to become the chief of integrated resources for the park. So it's kind of an overarching managerial position that is in charge of all the scientists there. I come, you know, as an archaeologist with a strong background in cultural resources, but I was in that capacity also in charge of the biologists and the botanists, and they had a fisheries person, and there's historic orchards up there. Fortunately, the natural resources side of that park was very strong, didn't require much in the way of management, but the cultural resources side of things really needed a lot of help. And that was really what I was brought in for, was to kind of aid them in getting up to speed in various studies that they have going on up there.
And so tell us how big the park is and what's there.
So, boy, I'm not good with numbers. In the Park Service, we call it a postage stamp park. It's basically a mountain range that they cut out the heart of and turned into a national park.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got Fremont culture stuff and then into, you know, the last 500 years, Numic stuff, Shoshonean, Goshute, Paiute type stuff. But what they have there are a lot of pictographs.
And petroglyphs too, or just mainly?
There are petroglyphs in the region. They tend to be down in lower areas. But this mountain range that this park encompasses has a lot of limestone and a lot of cave features. Stalagmites, stalactites.
What's the elevation?
The highest peak's 14,000 feet.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, but it comes all the way down to 4,500 feet.
Sure.
So they've got, you know, 1,000 feet of elevational differential in that park. So as you can imagine, there's resource availability from Great Basin Desert through large sagebrush steppe up into pinyon juniper and up into alpine communities.
Amazing. And all in that one national park.
Yeah. It's great. It's great. A lot of resource procurement going from Pleistocene dry lake beds all the way up into aspen and alpine communities there. So real diversity of archaeology, But what they really have been concentrating on in the last 10 years and what I've been helping out with is a lot of rock art studies in that park. Just today, on behalf of that park, we submitted what's called the Dunkahi National Register nomination, which is a study of Fremont pictographs in the mouths of a bunch of these limestone caves in the park. A graduate student had done a really wonderful study and development of this National Register nomination, which came back from the keeper of the National Register with pretty extensive editing and comments. And that was part of what I was doing up there, was going through this manuscript and editing it, and we just resubmitted it today.
Fantastic. Well, let's let it hang there for a moment. And in the next segment, we're going to try to understand a bit more about the archaeology and the rock art and how that is ensconced in this remarkable place. See you in the flip-flop, gang.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save big money
at Menards. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and we have the blessing and we're graced by David Nichols, who's going to talk to us about a number of different things. But I think on this segment, we're going to talk a bit about his experiences with the Great Basin National Park in the great state of Nevada and what he learned and what his reflections are. So you said there's quite a bit of archaeology, but also quite a bit of rock art. And you were sort of brought in, I guess, as a manager and resource person to assist them in probably trying to deal with the nature of those resources. Am I correct?
Yeah. I'd say the first month that I was up there it's an area both culturally and geographically that I'm really unfamiliar with. It's pretty far north and east of areas that I've worked previously, but I got familiar with especially their cultural resource issues within the first month I was up there.
Give us a thumbnail sketch of what some of the managerial issues might be and what the challenges are in dealing with issues of archaeology and rock art in a remarkable place like this.
It's a very natural resources rich and heavy park. They needed help with the cultural resources, and the cultural resources they have there are fascinating. They've got a mixed history, not prehistory, but history of Basque sheep herding and Mormon farming in the areas.
Wow.
So one of the things I never dealt with before that I got to deal with up there were dendroglyphs. And these are carvings into the white trunks of aspen trees from the late 1800s until the 1950s, and the Basque sheep herders would be up there and documenting what they're doing and their lonesomeness and writing poems and drawing photographs, some of which are rather pornographic, into the trunks of these trees. And as you can imagine, it's something that needed to be documented, and they just finished doing it, documenting all of these dendroglyphs up there. Yeah, because once the tree dies, that's it. You've lost that resource.
Wow. How did they go about that? Did they do it on contract?
They did it with park staff and seasonal employees. And they did systematic survey through these aspen groves and photographed and documented everything. And then another sort of a historic rock art, as it were, issue that they have is within the caverns. They have caverns there. They're called the Lehman Caves. They were discovered in like 1883 immediately started having tours in there. So you have you have historic inscriptions in the caves dating to the late 19th century of names and families of people that still can draw descendancy into the areas today.
Fabulous.
And it's interesting because they lead tours through these caves, and the issue of how to conserve and manage the existing inscriptions that are in there is something that I had to deal with while I was there. And it's part of a larger picture of a National Register nomination that we're doing for those caves also.
So the caves themselves, are they mainly natural, you know, resources, or is there archaeology there? Is there rock art there? I guess there is historic inscriptions there.
Right.
And yeah. are they mainly Euro-Americans, or are there other different ethnicities that are represented?
That's a fantastic question, because there actually are Japanese inscriptions from the late 1800s from Japanese miners that had been working up in Ely, Nevada. And there's one particular panel where they were invited in, and they put their inscriptions in Japanese. And I think those date to like 1896 or so. The rest are Euro-Americans. And as for other features, like I said, most of the prehistoric pictographs, I haven't seen petroglyphs, but pictographs are that Fremont style.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they tend to be in the mouths of these caverns. The caverns are all natural. They're geologic phenomena. Some of the other archaeological resources that are in there are constructions that were made by the Civilian Conservation Corps in the 1930s, constructing things inside of the caves that would make it easier for the public to tour through the caverns. So I think it was President Herbert Hoover that made Lehman Caves National Monument a national monument in the 30s.
So, David, you alluded to the fact that the rock paintings are within the mouths of these limestone caverns. Tell me more.
Yeah, so the prehistoric rock art is in the mouths of these things. They tend to be, I'd say, 99% done in red ochre. They're Fremont style. They're pictographs. I haven't seen any petroglyphs. And, you know, into the proto and historic periods, the Numa were in the areas, the Goshute, the Shoshone, and related Paiute peoples. I don't know what their expressions might look like in terms of rock art, but everything that I understand that I've seen up there has been the Fremont style, which has been studied and well-developed.
So what are the characteristics of the Fremont style that sort of shout that this is Fremont?
So you'll get, you know, your typical zoomorphs, which up there could be bighorn sheep, and they have pronghorn, but the anthropomorphic figures are those. Many people have seen them in books, those kind of triangular heads with like ear bobs that sort of sway out to the sides.
Yeah, they're very elaborate and ceremonially sophisticated, very elaborate.
Right. Yeah. And it's all about the headdress type stuff.
Yeah.
It's neat stuff. I wish I had been able to see more of it, but they brought me up there through the winter, and
right. God,
it snowed from day one, so a lot of my access was blocked to a lot of these areas.
Well, as I mentioned to you offline, I had the luxury one time of going to, it was Utah, and seeing the bighorn sheep headdress that existed at one of the museums. Mm-hmm. And it happens that museum is, in fact, the museum that displays those incredible figurines that are the parallels of those rock art images. They look like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band in terms of the elaborate nature of those images.
Right.
So obviously some of this looks like it might be about fertility. because I know that some of them are certainly feminine, but others are certainly masculine, far more masculine, and very, very prominent, and prestigious, and ritually elaborated, are they not?
Yeah, yeah. In terms of gender differentiation, I just, you know, for the 120 days I was up there, I didn't read or learn enough, and certainly wasn't able to get into the scholarly papers as I would mm-hmm. have if mm-hmm. I'd been there a little bit longer. But what you yeah. say, yeah, I mean, that's what they believe. Our next step along the lines of these studies, though, is we're developing, and I just put the paperwork together, an ethnographic yeah. study going back to the tribes to get a feeling for, through interviews, what their feelings are about the rock art and the caves and more in general. So that's going to be a really interesting study.
Absolutely. And very relevant, very important. And centrally, I'd say, very interesting and of great, something that really has been necessary and important and valuable that hasn't been done with great regularity, has it?
No, and this study is specific to the caves. And you know, there's okay. always this false premise, this false argument that these cultures have lost all continuity with what their societies look like pre-contact. But in reality, you know, the story grandpa tells you that slipped through 3-4 generations, there's always something there. And it needs to be analyzed, and it needs to be looked at, and those stories need to be taken seriously.
And often those stories are sort of the central keystones to opening up and understanding and illuminating the imagery, are they not?
Well, it depends. It depends. Until the study's done.
You don't know.
Yeah, you don't know. I mean, really, you don't. And you rock art guys, you know.
you always say this.
I always do. I have to. I have to take a step back and say, you know, I have to always say I'm a generalist. I'm
yeah, not you say, oh, you got all these rock art guys. Oh my god,
yeah, the rock art guys. You guys are bold, man. You're the Captain Kirk of the archaeological societies coming into the 21st century. That's for sure.
But it is, you know, I think that's something that we should at least touch upon, and that is the issue of kind of archaeological interpretation. And I know that in some camps, they would have us say, well, it's rock art, Alan, and you can be anything you want it to be. It's an open forum. But the way I see it sometimes, not always, is that it's simply a data set that is that is tremendously informative. And with the proper questions and analytical techniques and ethnographic analogies, and also looking at it using kind of an eye towards cognitive neuroscience and right. neurophysiology, et cetera, and some of the cutting edge stuff we're doing yeah. these days, I think there's a chance, sometimes a rather informative one, that we can illuminate and ask better, more informative, more informed questions. How's that?
Yeah, and you know, exactly what you just said encapsulates the most and best that we can do in modern archaeology towards an understanding of what rock art is and was and what it can mean. And this ethnographic study that we're going to be doing for Great Basin, I consider that a baseline study towards the furtherment of trying to figure out what's going on with the rock art up there. And again, I'd like to reiterate, those slivers of information that are passed down through the generations that grandfather told to grandson, they do make it. That's been shown. And I can't wait to see what probably we're going to have cultural anthropologists or ethnographers do the study, but I'll be really curious to see sure. what they come up with.
So that's an informative and somewhat, I'd say, innovative, not necessarily innovative, but it is, I think it's becoming more part of the practice of doing anthropology, archaeology, cultural resources management, and almost like a participatory anthropological study. I know Stoffel's been famous for doing this kind of work, and some of his students as well.
Yeah, 15, 20 years ago, the ethnohistorical approach was all the rage, and right. I can say that we've basically incorporated that into the larger ethnographic studies that we do these days. We don't quite parcel it out, technically like that anymore.
Right. Well, let's stop there, and maybe in the last segment, we can talk about what this means to those who visit the rock art sites and somehow what they can see, what they can feel, and how they can take away something that gives them a better sense of who they are on the planet and perhaps the abiding mysteries. See you on the flip-flop, gang.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save big money
at Menards. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, with our guest scholar, David Nichols, talking about his experiences and his expertise in the areas of cultural resource management, but also understanding and appreciating native cultural values.
Yeah.
With that in mind, David, so where's the beef? What is it that motivates people to want to go to these national parks, these national monuments? Why are they valued, and what's the treasure here? What do they get from doing this?
So look, those of us that are hired on as resource managers with the National Park Service, ours is a twofold responsibility, one of which is to pursue scientific research and studies in the parks. And as an archaeologist, naturally, what I'm going to be looking at is archaeology, both prehistoric and historic. And in the case of the rock art studies that we're doing, we're going about doing the ethnography, we're going to look at impacts, we're going to look at visitation. And then our other responsibility is to interpret that information as a public entity to people that are coming to the park. They're coming for the natural and the cultural resources. So people are going to lean one way or the other as a happenstance. But a lot of what we're going to do is going to have a public interpretive value to it. So when we get these studies back, how do we interpret them to the public in a manner that is digestible, not overly technical, but engages their interest and shares the results of our studies with them? In the case of rock art, what are we going to understand from it? How is that going to engage the public in a way that they're going to say, oh, I get it. I understand why the Park Service spent X amount of money on doing this. And I also appreciate the engagement with the tribes and their sharing of knowledge. And now I feel a little bit better about it as I step away.
So tell me how the situation has changed over the course of your association with the parks. What's happening now that it didn't happen years ago?
A lot more engagement and respect of tribal input, their perspectives, their feelings, their thoughts. Having an open ears and an open heart to what previously would have been ignored, which would have been sort of the grandiose scholars stepping into these sort of situations and lording it over, but not only tribes, but the general public, and saying, this is what it is, and that's what I'm dictating to you. Just in the 20 plus years I've been with the Park Service, the value of shared knowledge and soliciting input from, and the public as well, even the public that's not that familiar with these resources, have a say in how to interpret and what they want to see and the value that they're getting from it. That's what I see. But mostly it's tribal engagement. That's grown hugely. and it's important.
And are these federally recognized tribes, or are they tribes that are not federally recognized but are now being incorporated into the exercise of the research and the heritage values?
That's a great question. Legally, we are only mandated to consult with federally recognized tribes, but guess what? There's no National Park Service employee that would ignore the non-federally recognized tribes. We engage with anybody that claims descendancy, and we have an open ears and open heart. Again, I've said that before, and their input is as valued.
So give us maybe a couple of examples of how you see this working. How does someone go about sort of gleaning an interactive voice and sort of developing this interchange between the native people and capturing their perspective?
Yeah, outside of the official studies that we conduct, anybody can send an email to the superintendent of any given national park. Emails that come to our superintendents at the parks I've worked at that have to do with cultural resources, he spins off onto me, and I respond personally to the public on any engagement concerning cultural resources. I get volunteers through that. I end up with volunteers moving on to graduate school and becoming professionals in archaeology or other cultural resources aspects of the profession. So, it's engagement at its most basic sense.
So just from entertaining the notion of asking questions, you then have an interactive dialogue, and you don't know where that's going to lead.
Right.
That could in fact provide someone with an opportunity to do advanced, academic work. It could actually be on a track where someone, a native person perhaps, finds a niche in the realm of cultural resources management. Has that happened?
Yeah, and that does happen. That absolutely happens.
Give me some details about that. Tell me the story.
Well, in many cases, there's been examples of people of Native backgrounds going on, getting that education, bringing it back home to their own tribes. An example of engagement with the tribes, I'm utilizing the Colorado River Indian tribes. Mm-hmm. To assess archaeology here at Mojave National Preserve. They're going to start in mm-hmm. the fall, and they're going to be assessing their ancestors' sites, which is appropriate. I'm going to train them in field methodologies and condition assessments on prehistoric archaeology, and they're going to be looking at, most specifically, rock art that was done by their ancestors. And it's really fascinating. It's the first time we've done this at Mojave National Preserve. And so I'm curious to see where this thread is going to lead.
How did you come about that particular perspective or strategy? What brought you to this interesting juncture?
Yeah, I myself am actually a tribal citizen of the Muscogee Nation, federally recognized.
Okay.
And so I'm part of a National Park Service Indigenous employees group. Uh-huh. And I learned through them about this youth engagement program specific to North American tribes, got a couple contact names, called them up, told them what my proposal was, and we engaged, and we're moving forward from there. And I'm not local to this area tribally, right. So I'm engaging the tribes that are descendants. And this is their traditional homeland.
So the particular groups that would be involved would be, I would think, the Chemehuevi or the Mojave or the Kitsan and other groups along those lines.
Right. So very specific to this area is going to be the Mojave and the Chemehuevi.
Yeah.
But the Colorado River Indian Tribes Reservation is an interesting one in that it also includes Navajo and I think some Hopi or Zuni there. I'm going to be curious to see who they send my way.
Well, that's fascinating. And congratulations on sort of opening up that dialogue and working on this sort of the cultural heritage values that need recognition and need something that, sort of
begins to sort of break down those barriers. I've noticed that often that archaeologists are reticent to talk with native people.
That's your generation, Alan.
They seem to be good at dealing with artifacts and physical things. But when it comes to dealing with people and their values and their observations and religious elements and cosmology, all all of these very personal yet extremely relevant elements to the understanding of rock art, we get into a little bit of a different interchange, don't we? It's something that only certain kinds of people are best prepared to sort of walk that line or develop that kind of communication. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I mean, the times of narrowly focused research and inclusion of only specific peoples with backgrounds, that's over. That's in the past. Yeah, I mean, everything that you said, I totally buy into, and that's the way in the future of these types of studies.
So we're entering into a new sort of, I'd say a new way of thinking, much more of a dynamic way of thinking, an interdisciplinary way, but also one that sort of dismantles our structure of knowing. And we're looking at rock art and archaeology not only from a Western scientific view, but from a native viewpoint. And that is rather different, is it not?
Yeah, and that this is not a sudden thing. I mean, this has been developing, you know, for a couple decades now.
Sure, yeah.
But definitely stuff that you've done and that you've written and a couple other people that I respect, you're the forefront of it, Alan. I've always respected your work and love being brought into these podcasts. It's fun to discuss.
Yeah, we're pushing the big rock up the hill.
Yeah.
and again, just you know, to be totally objective here, it's not so easy to be a gringo sometimes and a non-native. You're viewed with suspect, and it takes a kind of a different way of sort of thinking to sort of breach these topics and discover some of the most interesting and compelling elements of the nature of these images and the archaeology.
Yeah.
I would think.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's how it happened to me. It's just, you know, you spend 40 years studying something, but if you spend 4 years working with the native people directly, you'll know more in 4 years than you will in 40 years.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the learnable things, and I consider it a method in archaeology, is respectful silence. Let people speak and let them have their turn and hear what they have to say and process it and incorporate it and use that as part of your study.
Well, respectful silence. What a concept.
Learnable.
Learnable. Yes. No, I like it. I like it a lot. And sort of in this chapter of my own life, I've been reflecting a lot on the interactions I'm having with native people and in general, some of the things that the archaeologists have done and said and believe and how they relate back to the native people and helping or hindering them in terms of their own goals and their own circumstances. And it's quite a burden to be involved in some of this, because we're dealing with a long line historically of this thing we can call colonialism.
Yeah.
And
ethnocentrism.
Also, ethnocentrism, but also dealing with the issues of how does a native person who's linked to the landscape and the land and their genealogy and the nature of their cosmology, how do they earn a living when there's really very little in the way of engines to do that in their particular locations? And so that's another conundrum that we have in terms of dealing with it. But, you know, I think occasionally there are ways and circumstances and opportunities for people to dismantle the structure of knowing, do some things, become cultural resources managers, liaisons, and what have you. And surprisingly enough, they can do certain things and be part of the solution. And I've seen that done in some of the projects I've been part of. And so it's an interesting exercise. How's that?
Yeah, I have nothing more to add to that. You summed it up nicely.
Well, I think we're at the end of our segment three. Why don't you give a hello and an invitation to all those people who listen and invite them over to one of these national monuments of yours.
Yeah, hey, for sure, man. I work all over the place. You know, I could be an avenue and a contact for anybody interested in National Park Service archaeology in general.
Fantastic.
And, yeah.
How do they get a hold of you?
The best way is through my official National Park Service email, which would be David_R_Nichols@nps.gov. And I answer emails from anybody and everybody same day.
Fantastic. Well, all you Rock Guard podcasters and fans of our Rock Guard podcast, thanks for tuning in and see you next week. See you on the flip flop.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.